My job is always the odd one. Am I on mic? Yes. Good, because I was about to say something mysterious. I was going to identify the exact date of the second coming, but if I'm on mic, I can't do that. It was just between the two of us. Talk about it later. My job is, in some ways, to talk about Christianity and culture, which is a little bit different than, you know, five reasons to believe in God. But before we plunge into that, I want to make an important suggestion. And that is, I have if we're talking religiously, not politically necessarily, but I have really conservative religious points of view. I believe the Bible is so true that I'm still working on Morocco leather on the back of mine. Now that I have a Kindle, I'm not sure if everything in the Kindle becomes inerrant because my Bible appears on it. I really think the Bible is true. But I'd like to suggest that sometimes when we have that kind of view, we act like our views are fragile, or that everything we believe is of equal importance. Like one of our views, we have a whole menu of things we believe, and if we changed our mind about one thing, that would cause us to change our minds about everything. I'd like to suggest that just like falling in love, the best way to approach loving Jesus is like loving each other, which is to be full of wonder. It's wonderful to wonder, not debilitating. I think sometimes when we think about wonder, it helps us because we believe in our culture the only way to be reasonable is to be skeptical. And that's true in the old meaning of the word skepticism. Skepticism is a great thing. If you're not skeptical and you go buy a car, you're going to get ripped off. If you're in relationships, not even because of sin, forget being hurt because people are evil. Pain is not bad. It's a sensor that says, hey, if you lean on your arm much longer, you're going to bruise it, move it. Pain isn't the result of the fall. If we lived in an unfallen world, pain would still be a good thing. Gratuitous pain is a problem for Christians. Why does God allow it? But pain itself, there's no reason, there's nothing wrong with pain. Pain is a good thing. In the same way, skepticism, having nothing to do with maybe you're going to rip me off, is a good thing if by it you mean wonder. So my wife is at home right now in Southern California. And what mood will she be in when she comes to the airport to pick me up? I wonder. Not because I dislike her, not because of sin, but because if you love someone, you recognize their personhood, and you wonder how to react to them, because though I can predict, we have to go do our taxes, that it won't be the most romantic homecoming I've ever had. There's something about the IRS that destroys romance. I'm not sure. If you're a tax accountant here, you probably have no children because of this. Because romance and the IRS just don't seem to go together. Maybe if you're an insider, it's the feeling of power. It goes the other way. I don't know. But the point is, I can predict that my wife will not be in a romantic mood, but I may get off the plane and I'm entirely wrong. I'm often wrong about that sort of thing. That's what's wonderful about knowing a person, right? People aren't predictable. And not because they're broken and sinful, but because they're people. And we're dealing, when we deal with God, with a person, not with a computer. So let me suggest to you that even if you come to the conclusion that very, very traditional Christian beliefs are true, as I have, the best way to do that is to do it the way you fall in love, which is to wonder about them all the time. If they're true, they can take it. If they're false, you didn't want to believe them anyway. So I sometimes meet people that think that if they consider whether evolution is true, that they'll fall off the deep end and immediately become an atheist. Or if they think about atheism, they'll immediately become an axe murderer. We get professors who are atheists who manage not to become axe murderers, right? Or worship goats in the basement or something. I mean, we need to realize that the faith isn't fragile, that our beliefs aren't fragile, and that it's okay to open our hands and our minds and live a life of wonder. I'm going to suggest to you what happens when we do the alternative, when we become bound, when we become ideological, when we try to turn a personal universe, a universe created by a personal God for persons, into an impersonal universe run by rules and solely by reason, so-called. My suggestion is that that will lead to destruction and death, whether the ideology is French Enlightenment thought, which is what I'm going to use as an example, or perverted forms of Christianity. Being right is no guarantee against becoming monstrous. My granddaddy used to describe people like this as so straight, they leaned a little. Have you ever known people like that? They're so straight, they lean a little. They agree with you on everything and you wish they didn't because they're nasty people. Well, we're about to look at a group of people that in reacting to a horrible set of problems actually made the world worse, though they intended not to. One of my favorite operas, not often performed in the United States, is a dialogue of a group of Carmelite nuns who during the French Revolution were guillotined. Here's a rule of thumb. If your ideology starts out to help the poor and ends up guillotining nuns, something's gone wrong. You know, it's like in ethics. It doesn't prove you're wrong if it's you and Hitler standing in a room together, but it should worry you. Right? It doesn't prove that you're wrong, but it's worrisome. You see, the French Revolution began with some good ideas, liberty and equality, and it ended in death. And we'll try to see why, what went wrong. It was a revolution based on the notion of reason. Here we have the goddess Reason being carried in. She's a prostitute or a courtesan, being carried into Notre Dame, where people pillaged this beautiful cathedral, defecated on the altar, and placed this prostitute up as the goddess Reason. We don't need any gods. We're going to be reasonable. Now, reason is one of those things that's hard to be against. So you'll notice that whenever you're dealing with somebody who wants to make you feel bad, they're for something like love. And the temptation, if you don't like them, is to fall into their trap and be against love. Yeah, that's right, we're for hate. You guys are loving, you guys are tolerant, we're intolerant. I've actually met some Christians that because tolerance has been taken in bad directions, pretend that tolerance isn't a good thing. They like embrace intolerance. They want to wear I'm intolerant t-shirts. I'd like to suggest to you that everybody should want to be reasonable, but you shouldn't only want to be reasonable. Why? What does reason deal with? Well, I think people say, I'm going to live my life logically. I'm going to live my life reasonably, and somehow that will solve all my problems. I won't be a jerk if I'm just reasonable. I may be wrong, but I'll try to do the reasonable thing. Now, I want to suggest that in a good person's life, there are lots of tools that they have that they need to use. And if you take one tool and you begin to worship it, it becomes the only tool you deploy. Pretty soon, your one tool, a hammer, means every single thing you see has to be a nail. See that problem? It's a nail. Bam! Does it look like a nail? No. Bam! But what we've got is, bam, a hammer. So we have to, bam, hit everything. This is a very bad idea. Sometimes you need a screwdriver. But of course, if you decide, I'm going to live my life centered around screwdrivers, then everything becomes a screw, and then you're screwed. I mean, it's just, just came out. I don't even know why. Now, what is reason? Reason is a way of thinking such that if you start with truth, you can produce more truths through valid arguments. So again, what is reason? It's a mechanism of thought whereby if you start with the truth and you think correctly, reasonably, you can't possibly come up with a falsehood. I just said it in a different way, the opposite way. Notice reason cannot tell you by itself what the truth is. If you put falsehoods in the reason machine, what will you produce? Falsehoods. So ancient science taught that men produced babies. Yes, I'm sorry, ladies, but that's what women were, just the carriers. They contributed only material substance to the child. If that's a fact, then you might deploy those facts and begin to ask questions like, are women fully human? Those are questions that were asked based on a false set of facts. In other words, you can be as logical as you want to be, but logic by itself will never tell you the truth. To live a good life, in other words, you need at least two tools: a truth detector and reasonableness. Once you have the truth, if you're not reasonable, it won't do you any good, unless it's accidental, right? You know the truth, but you're a bad thinker, so it does you no good. Is it good to be reasonable? Yes, because then the truth can be used to produce new truth or to help you make proper decisions. But notice, the truth itself cannot tell you what should be. Is, you can get a whole pile of is, and it doesn't tell you at all what ought to be. How do you know what ought to be? You use something called ethics, which is a different tool. So people in here, well, let's just do what science tells us to do. Can science tell us what ought to be? No, it can only tell us what is. Notice, if you say what is what ought to be, you're not doing science, you're doing philosophy. In other words, facts are great things, and certain sciences are good at accumulating them. Hooray! But notice, even then, we can believe something is a fact that isn't. Science told me, brush your teeth this way. Later, I went to the dentist and they said, oh, bad news, I can tell how old you are because we gave you advice about how to brush your teeth and you've put grooves in your teeth. Well done. Don't do that anymore. I killed my dentist and, no, I dentists like IRS agents, very unpopular people. Now, what's the point? People in the French Enlightenment got so enamored with a certain tool, reason, that they forgot that a lot of what they thought was reasonable simply were a set of prejudices that they put in the fact-grinding machine that produced error because the mix of fact and prejudice that they put in the reason machine gave them a mix of truth and falsehoods and couldn't tell them what society ought to look like anyway. They just somehow thought everyone knew. They took for granted at the time of the French Revolution what a lot of young adults take for granted. You know, I knew my dad. My dad was a pastor for 40-odd years, and I looked at his job, and I said, my dad's job is easy. All you have to do is do what he does every day minus his obvious mistakes. Have you noticed that? I mean, the founder and director of an honors college, I always have 18 to 22-year-olds come into my office and say, we would be so much better at your job. Because you should just stop doing this stupid thing you do. And they're usually right. Of course, what's the problem? Not so easy to be king. Easy to be Absalom, standing outside the door, to use a biblical example, telling people, David is very busy. If I were king, I'd listen to your problems. No, if you were king, you'd be consumed with everybody else's problems too. In other words, people looked at Christian France, which was in transition as Christianity produced a scientific and industrial revolution. Our political and cultural thinking did not keep up with the power that Christianity was beginning to give humankind. And so people took for granted what Christianity had produced and decided that they could do better by being Christian minus the Jesus stuff. In other words, they could run the company minus the mistakes. How did that go for them? The way it always goes. And by the way, if Christians do the same thing, they end up with the same problem. It always ends in blood. Always. For those of you who want a more culturally relevant point, we could look at the film that just came out. It's a fantastic film. I'm not sure it's appropriate for very young children, based on an excellent series of children's books called The Hunger Games, in which it's a dystopian set of novels. A capital city governs North America and exploits 12 regions who do things like mine coal, make products, while the capital city does nothing. It exists parasitically on the wealth of the working classes. What they do is consume and create kind of effete beauty and make fun of everyone out in the districts. Occasionally, then, they bring people in from the districts for the equivalent of Colosseum games. You will notice that ideological cultures, cultures that decide to worship liberty and reason, but detach liberty and reason from a Christian grounding, will eventually worship violence while becoming themselves effete, soft. In short, a lack of faith undergirding the use of reason will generally lead to disaster. Here is Robespierre, the leader of the French Revolution, described by one of my favorite writers, Anthony Trollope, Victorian novelist. Somebody start up here with the he thought and read it loudly. He thought himself what? Keep reading. He seems almost to have been sent into this world to prove the inefficiency of human reason to affect human happiness. If you look further in the quote, the great novelist says of Robespierre, who wanted to live by reason, honesty, moral conduct, industry, constancy of purpose, temperance in power, courage, and love of country. That sound good to you? Would you like to have a leader with all those qualities? Would you vote for a person like that for president? I hope not. I hope not. Because all these virtues belong to Robespierre. History confesses it. And to what favored hero does history assign a fairer catalog? Whose name does a brighter galaxy adorn? With such qualities, such attributes, why was he not the George Washington of France? Why, instead of the Messiah of freedom, which he believed himself to be, has his name become a byword, a reproach, and an enormity? Let me remind you that the French revolutionaries ended up killing more people in a few months than the ancient regime had killed in 100 years. Because he lacked faith. He believed in nothing but himself, and the reasoning faculty with which he felt himself to be endowed. He thought himself perfect in his own human nature, and wishing to make others perfect as he was, he fell into the lowest abyss of crime and misery in which a poor human creature ever wallowed. Trollope is, of course, writing before Nazism or communism, which are simply the same problem with the power of modern science. He seems almost to have been sent into the world to prove the inefficiency of human reason to affect human happiness. He was gifted with a power over common temptation which belongs to but few. His blood was cool and temperate, and yet his heart was open to all the softer emotions. He had no appetite for luxury, no desire for pomp, no craving for wealth. Among thousands who were reveling in sensuality, he kept himself pure and immaculate. If any man could have said, "I will be virtuous, I of myself unaided, trusting to my own power, guarding myself by the light of my own reason, I will walk uprightly through the world and will shed light from my path upon my brethren," he might have said so. He attempted it. And history shows us the result. He attempted, unassisted, to be perfect among men. And his memory is regarded as that of a loathsome plague, defiling even the unclean age in which he lived. Reason is a tool, but a tool that requires data. What's the first problem of human beings unattached from the divine? The chief problem is deciding what ought to be. This is Don Quixote, man of La Mancha, right? Don Quixote saw not what is, but what he wished was. How'd that work out for him? Not well. If I try with the IRS to treat my finances not as they are, but as I wish they were, this will go badly. On the other hand, the IRS didn't fall out of heaven, trust me, and the tax laws are not from the mouth of God. So a free human being can say, "Ought I to obey these tax laws?" And the minute a free human being asks that question, government has to justify itself. It cannot simply say, "We're just being reasonable." Why ought I to pay this tax? And yet, let me remind you that God, who so loved humankind, that he wanted to give us a free choice to the extent that he put a tree in a garden and allowed us to choose whether or not we would eat of the fruit. Gave us, even if you count all the ceremonial law of the Old Testament, no more than 700 rules to live by. Governments, once they detach themselves from God, will give you more rules to govern the color you can paint your house than exists in the entire Old Testament. And yet always, always, when we move from a divinely based political and ethical system, it will seem like a move towards freedom and liberty. Because the belief will be, we'll be Christian minus those dumb sex rules or oppressive this or that. And then because Christians often haven't correctly worked out how to love God and love their neighbor, we will have created some oppressive systems. But it will be forgotten that your ought and my ought are equal because we're both humans. And if there's no court of appeal beyond us, it will come down to violence and power. It always has, and it always will. Because you see, there is a distinction between the words liberty and libertine. Liberty is the absolute right under God to do any good thing you wish. No government, no church, no pope, no prelate can stop you licitly from doing good. You have an absolute right inside of the Judeo-Christian ethic to life and liberty. And the pursuit of happiness, which means human flourishing, eudaimonia, the ability to be fully a man or a woman. You do not have the right to vice. There exists no right to vice. It might be that a prudent government will choose to allow you to do a thing. Because as Christian philosophers pointed out, to utterly close out prostitution and destroy the red light district in every city would be to give the government powers that the government cannot be trusted with. So a Christian society tolerates private behavior that it thinks wrong because it recognizes it need not make every vice illegal. That would be dangerous. But you have no right to vice, merely the ability to choose it. The minute my personal quest for pleasure is substituted for the Christian and Jewish and Islamic notion of liberty, tyranny will inevitably follow, even if it's done by a church. Why? Because you can have liberty or you can have equality. You cannot have both. No human is equal to any other. What does it even mean to say a human is equal? You're not equal to me. I'm not equal to you. You are a unique creation in God's image, not replaceable, not a part, not a cog in a machine. True justice, would treat you based on everything there is to know about you and your role in the cosmos? Why is justice blind in a courthouse? Not just because fallen human beings can't know everything, but because the mercy that would come if we did know everything like God does cannot be applied by civil government because we cannot trust them with that power. We create the fiction of equality before the law to protect us from the arbitrary rule of humans. But we have to remind ourselves, just like a corporation is a fictive person, and it's useful in business to pretend that Eastman Kodak is a person, so that when they go bankrupt, all the people who work for Kodak don't have to suffer, right? But every once in a while, you have to pause and say what? Eastman Kodak isn't really a person. It's a creative fiction. A dollar bill isn't really of value. You are of value. A dollar bill has fictive or creative value, which is a good thing, to serve people. And the law amongst men and women exists to treat us equally because we can't be trusted with full liberty. But if there were no sin, there would be no law. And everyone could be treated, if King Jesus were ruling us, with perfect justice. If we become obsessed with equality, so that we decide what I want is to be equal, on what basis will that equality come? IQ? Skin color? Height? Ability to help society? Every time we've tried to establish a basis for equality, it has ended up devaluing another class of human beings. Because if I declare we're equal, the obvious truth that in some ways we are not equal, you're younger or faster or smarter or stronger or more persuasive or part of the dominant political party, will mean that the comrades will set up a hierarchy of merit far more severe than any hierarchy based on birth. Liberty without God always has become decadent and bloody. And to those tempted by the late Christopher Hitchens' view that religion does no good, I will match the history of religious violence, which can be condemned on religious grounds, in a moment, against the history of sectarian secular violence that on any given weekend claims more lives than the Inquisition claimed in its entire history. And the Inquisition became the basis of international law, because the church courts were widely viewed as more just and more principled than secular courts. And the notion that a man in France could be tried in the same way as a man in Spain or in England or a woman before the bar actually instituted deep and important changes in the legal system. And it was also abused by wicked men and perverted and used to torture and to destroy God-given liberty. But it could be condemned from within because it had the resources to correct itself. The French Revolution had no such resources, so it ended in tyranny. as it always does. Fraternity, that is brotherhood, which we think will be sufficient. Do whatever you want as long as you don't. No, really, we walk out into the mall and say, look, we don't need God. Here's our rule. You can do whatever makes you happy as long as you don't hurt anyone. That's used to be called fraternity. That's now viewed as kind of sexist, right? The brotherhood of humanity. It's not good enough. Why? Because who decides what is hurt? Does it matter that our pursuit of pleasure in the capital city means that the 12 outlying districts live horrible lives? Why isn't that a good thing? Doesn't our happiness, which is very great, outweigh their misery? Don't they work so we can produce awesome culture? Why are we hurting them? They're living satisfactory lives. What counts as hurt? Let's assume, okay, it's bad because you're killing people. Would it be bad if I yell at you? Is it bad if I say no to you? Is it bad if I spend up the cultural seed corn so that 100 years from now, my great-grandchildren will live in ruins? But I don't know my great-grandchildren. I'm never going to know them. Why am I accountable to my great-grandchildren? As one English woman pointed out, nobody my age is having children. And people keep telling us we're selfish because my demographic group in Britain is dying out. Thank God I am selfish. What do I care about a generation 100 years from now? Who am I hurting? And the answer is, nobody, because those people don't exist yet and never will exist because she's not having them. Fraternity will ultimately lead, weirdly, this belief, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt anyone, to absolute conformity or doing only what sells or is practical. Look around this room. Do you see a great diversity in clothing? You do not. Do you see a great diversity in the way we are allowed to dress? No, more and more we see conformity, mass culture. The internet, oh look, we can say whatever we want. We can go wherever we want. We can read any ideas. Look at people's browsers and what will you discover? They could go anywhere. I bet they go to 5 or 6 sites every day in a little circle. More and more produced by the same mass marketing companies. Because if you're guided by your pleasures, as long as you don't hurt anyone, you will end up looking just like the animal next to you or the animal next to you. Where is the motive to do the almost monastic-like discipline required to produce modern science? Where is the motive to get anything other than a cushy government job that requires no challenge? Where is the motive to start a new business and produce great risk? Where does the ought come from? Godless revolt has always ended in the rule of tyrants, whether the tyrant was Napoleon or Lenin. Find me an example of a secular revolt that hasn't ended in tyranny, and I will only be able to show you Western Europe now. My friends who are secular like to point out that places like Sweden or Great Britain today are becoming overwhelmingly secular, but free. I say to them two things. First, as recently as the 1950s, Western Europe was still overwhelmingly Christian. Second, the process of secularization is not nearly complete. Third, I see no indication that Western Europe can defend itself without moving to tyranny. That Western Europe doesn't have all the indications of being a rotten, hollowed out corpse waiting for revolution, either from the right or the left. You're dead just the same. Reason must be incarnate to speak to humans, but only a God-man can be trusted with that much power. What we need to produce a liberal society is for the Logos, God, to become human and dwell among us so that we can behold for ourselves his glory full of grace and truth. And then, if we are to be free, we need that God-man to hide himself so that his power does not overwhelm us, so that we can move from the childhood of humanity to full adulthood by freely choosing to become men and women of integrity. Not because the law made us, but because we developed real adult virtue. Oh, that's just Christianity. And that's how liberal societies were produced. But when courts in California can declare that the will of the people can be set aside based solely on the reason of an elite minority, whatever the merits of the particular cause, free men and women should be worried. Because as we can already see in Western Europe, the calls for Madame Guillotine follow soon after for those who will not embrace the new reasonable position. After all, aren't Christians who raise their children as Christians engaging in a form of child abuse? What is the answer? Revolt against our masters. But not in an angry way. Because, as the great thinker, Christian thinker, Alexander Solzhenitsyn discovered, even if we were to be persecuted, as I think we will be, and sent to concentration camps, as I believe we will not be, what Solzhenitsyn found in those camps was great disappointment. Why? Because what you think is, at last, I'm with the good people. The bad people have shown their hands. And now all the good people are in camps suffering and being purified, and the bad people are running the camps. At last, the wheat and the tares have been separated, and now we know. What did he discover inside the great Gulag archipelago, which for some reason atheists feel no responsibility for, that killed at least 22 million Christians during many of your lifetimes, that continues in places like North Korea and China in the name of atheism? If theism is responsible for Iran, why isn't atheism responsible for North Korea? I'll take the culture of Iran 100 times over the culture of North Korea, by the way. At its worst, theism is more culturally fecund than atheism, which simply devolves into a cult of personality every time. You see, why Solzhenitsyn said, are so many of the guards nicer, better than so many of us? He wasn't justifying the camps, but here was his horrible discovery. You and I are in the camp being selfish and stealing food from each other. The guard might be compassionate and wise. He wasn't justifying the gulag. What did he discover? The line between good and evil doesn't run through those nasty atheists over there and us, the righteous few. It runs through the center of every human heart. In what way are we equal? We are equally capable of setting up a gulag, yes, even in the name of Jesus, and equally capable of being souls created in the image of God, full of virtue and liberty. There is no person so corrupt that the image of God does not dwell in them, which is why Christian nations have come to the conclusion that you cannot torture any human being for any reason. Because no human being is so vile that other human beings have a right to do that. Nor do Christian nations kick a corpse or a cadaver or rejoice when a man is executed. We may kill bin Laden the terrorist, but we must mourn bin Laden the man. Because if we saw as God saw, we would see that we are not wholly righteous and bin Laden wholly wicked. So though we must in a fallen world execute justice, we do so in humility in a Christian nation, taking no joy in the death of any human being. We do not stand at the guillotine and cheer. So that the conclusion of everything I've said, the heart of a Christian worldview when it comes to culture, is that we're not the good guys. And there exists some bad guys. The French monarchy was no good. So were the revolutionaries. The revolutionaries meant well. They had a lot of virtue. They did a lot of good. The Soviet Union produced some good things. It's all corrupt. And so we live our lives with humility and wonder, allowing Jesus to slowly transform us, loving our neighbor as we would be loved. And so we hope, against hope, not to see some utopia this side of paradise, but to see men and women best we can treated not with equality, but with justice. I may not have to feed my neighbor. My neighbor may not deserve it. But I will because I love my neighbor. What no government should make me do, I will voluntarily do. I will keep no human being a slave or a captive. And I will proclaim liberty on the earth because I will do to others as God is slowly doing in history, which is reconciling everything, no matter how wicked, to himself. The crooked will be made the rough places. And justice will roll down like a mighty water. Thank you. God bless you.